right. We are back. Hello, Tonaloni.
I don't answer to that. I will not answer to that. Wait, where did that come from?
Antonio and Tony.
Antonio, I'd answer to that. And Tonaloni, I don't think I... Antonioni, you were trying to say.
Yeah.
I'd answer to Antonioni.
Thank you all for your nice comments about our episode with Puppy Bowl ref Dan Shackner. We felt like everyone needed a couple weeks to just kind of process that episode. We know we needed some time.
I needed to recover from that. I had quite an episode.
Oh, that was a lot of fun. Tonight we're talking dream scenario. And I'll tell you something. You know what's a dream scenario, Tony? It's not only doing this podcast with you, but when you take us back in history, which you are about to do, this year, 1935, I believe, the best paranormal movies of 1935.
Uh-huh.
But before we do that, let's talk about something else in the agenda. Our top three tonight, based on something from Dream Scenario, will be what, Tony? Top three what in film history tonight?
Oh, God, I got to look at my notes. What did we decide? We're doing top...
Nerds!
Full
nerding,
nerd.
Nerding out, going full nerd.
Top three full nerd.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm proud of that idea.
How have you been?
I'm good. I'm fine. Everything is great. Yeah. You know, everything is great. No complaints.
Yep.
How about yourself? I mean, what do we need to talk about? I got nothing for a junk drawer.
No, I mean, gosh, there's so much I've probably watched since we've last spoken.
Mm-hmm.
But most of it wouldn't even really necessarily fit on this show. Like, I started watching this Netflix documentary series called Full Swing Season 2. It's about professional golfers, life on tour.
Right. That wouldn't really go on the show.
It's actually really well done. But it also makes me in a rage because they deal with this thing going on in golf about this LIV, which is Saudi money. It's a offshoot league paid for by Saudi money. And it's just a mess.
Boy, it's way above my understanding. I don't know. I really don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, no one does.
I mean, you can feel free to explain it, but I don't know what you're saying.
No one who listens to the podcast has any idea what I'm talking about. So I'm going to move on. I'm trying to think of something I've seen or done that would pertain to this very podcast. Actually, I've been listening to a podcast for quite some time. I listened to a 3-hour episode in the last week or so over time, not all at once. And it actually pertained in a big way to this film, the topic, the subject matter. So I want to bring that up as we move on through the movie, because it kept striking me like, oh my gosh, this movie in some sense is commenting on what this podcast was commenting upon. It's kind of a philosopher's podcast. These theologians get together and talk about these deep issues. It's kind of dense. It's not something you listen to when you're like doing housework. You got to kind of like really pay attention to it.
Yeah. Theologians require your full attention.
It's kind of like the opposite of this podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I hope nobody's really actually paying that much attention. So what's going on here?
Yeah, like thoughtful dialogue as opposed to...
Just don't pay that much attention. I mean, listen, tune in, subscribe, send likes. We love that. We love the interaction. Just don't... It's not... You don't have to pay that much attention.
It's best. It's best.
It's better to you just look with only part of your attention.
In fact, just delete them all as soon as you listen to them, please.
You can... But if you can delete after you've subscribed and downloaded...
Yeah.
You know.
Download, then delete. So there's no record. Nothing will be used in as evidence against
Sure,
us.
We don't need that, no.
So yeah, let's get right into it.
And now Tony takes us to the movies. This week.
1935. Notable for one thing and one thing only, as far as I can see.
Wizard of Oz?
Bride of Frankenstein.
Oh. Wow, that's a big one.
Bride of Frankenstein. Pretty big deal. This was the sequel, obviously, bringing back Karloff and Colin Clive of It's Alive fame and introducing Elsa Lancaster. Well, I don't think introducing. I think she'd been in some stuff, but
okay.
This was her big claim to fame as the bride, basing her performance on the Hissing Swans in Regent Park. Apparently.
Wait. So hold on. Say that again. So she based her performance on Hissing Swans?
Yes. She has a very famous moment where her reaction to coming alive and seeing seeing Karloff for the first time is to hiss, and she hisses kind of like a cat or a swan, actually. And you, I read that, yeah, she was studying how to do this character physically and was inspired by the swans in Regent Park.
Holy moly.
You wouldn't hear that on a lot of other podcasts.
Have you ever based your, I'm quite serious, I'm not being facetious. Have you ever based anything you've ever done on stage and theater or in film or in TV in your vast career on any sort of animal movement or behavior? It's a great question.
That is a really great question.
I just patted myself on the back for a question.
Yeah, that's a good, for a legit actor, that would be a great, interesting question because there'd be a good answer. No, I don't think I have. I have like in class.
Yeah, right.
Your exercises where you have to do it.
Yes.
And I don't think I've ever gotten to play a part that interesting, you know, to require me to do that. No, that's not completely true. I did a play called The Wanderer.
I knew there'd be something.
Yeah. And it actually is a play I did with Amelia a long time ago.
Oh,
great play. Kind of a supernatural play. It was something we could have talked about on the show.
Wow.
And I played a kind of a supernatural being, like a benign vampire, like a vampire that helps people.
It was weird.
So I remember kind of thinking about how he was physically and not being human, and I did kind of do some of that. I'm not going to tell you what animal though.
That's awesome. Maybe a bat would be wise.
But I do have something else in common here, as you know.
What?
I did a show with an injury.
Yeah, you sure did.
And so did Boris Karloff. He shot half of this movie or more with a dislocated hip.
Oh my God!
Yeah, wearing all that, you know, heavy. He had like 100 pounds of gear, boots, and makeup and stuff on. Kept working.
They were tough back then. I was just talking to my little morning radio show I do here in Rhode Island this morning. There was some story about like Adele or whatever singers, like, oh, I was told by doctors I'm going to shut down my Vegas residency because I'm sick. And I just thought to myself, I just pictured Frank Sinatra like bursting through the door and be like, here's a shot of whiskey. Get back on stage. They paid money to go see you.
Get back to work, baby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure she's ill, but I just thought it was a funny thing to say.
Sinatra in Frankenstein would have been good. That's the big news from 1935. I mean, we got Werewolf of London starring Henry Hull, which is a great werewolf movie.
I didn't know there was a werewolf in London before the song.
There was from 1935. Henry Hull played the werewolf coming back from an expedition in Tibet.
I see.
He was bitten by a werewolf in Tibet, and he comes back and terrorizes London. As you do. And then we got The Ghost Goes West, which is a kind of a comedy ghost movie directed by Rene Clair, who's a great director. Movie called She, from the producers of King Kong.
Oh, wow.
About people looking for the Fountain of Youth.
Ooh.
And then we have the movie called The Clairvoyant with the great Claude Rains as a mind reader.
Oh, wow.
That's all we got. That's what we got.
And obviously Bride of Frankenstein is the big one. Is it the best, though, would you say? Of them, it's the most famous.
I've never seen I haven't seen three of these.
Okay.
I've seen Werewolf of London, and it's good.
Okay,
but it's no Bride of Frankenstein. Bride of Frankenstein is kind of a like a benchmark for genre movies in general. Mm-hmm. It's really gorgeous. It's really beautifully shot and great.
Dated a girl in my Boston years who had a white streak in her hair like the Bride of Frankenstein, and she swore it was real. I was convinced that we were 24 or 5 at the time, but she had this like gray white streak through her black hair, just one streak. And I was like, come on, you're doing the Bride of Frankenstein thing. She's like, no, it's real. And I would stare at it sometimes.
You were dating Susie and the Banshees. I didn't know that.
It might have been them.
Or just one of the Banshees.
No, it was probably the entire band.
Yes. Go. You live. Go. You stay. We belong dead.
I had a science teacher with a stripe in his hair.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Huh.
With a white stripe in his hair.
Didn't people make mean like skunk jokes?
All the time. All the time. It was terrible. We were very mean.
Poor guy.
He played well with it though. He rolled with it. He could have dyed it. I think he used it. I think it was like his little claim to fame in school. Interesting tie-in maybe to this film. It was his one thing that made him everybody think about him. You know?
Love it. There you go. White and stripe that is hair. The segue I was sloppily searching for.
You were lurching around trying to find that.
Here we go.
Segue. Where did I put that?
2023's dream scenario. Let's do it.
Rest assured that after violently attacking a middle school teacher last fall, Paul Matthews disappeared from the public eye and our collective dreams altogether. But through the case of Paul came one silver lining, a revolution in dream science. So now, forget the nightmares and experience a positive way of dream travel with Norio.
Welcome to Dream House!
This is the Dream House, on top of the Hollywood Hills, where the next big thing is happening. Ads in your dreams.
Dreamfluencers, or like mindvertisers.
Nicolas Cage is a tenured professor who ends up appearing in people's dreams. That is the very, very basic setup of Dream Scenario 2023. Tony, I just happened to Google Paranormal Movies 2023. I was looking for something new, and this came up as one of the choices. I knew nothing about it. It was produced by Nick Cage. Had you heard of this? Did you know about it?
I'd seen the posters for it. I hadn't even seen a trailer for it.
Got it.
I knew that Cage was, I guess, on a bit of a streak lately. He's had a few movies back-to-back that people were talking about. But I didn't know the director or the movie. Had you seen the trailer for it?
Nothing. As a matter of fact, I tried not to see anything about it. I just got it on Amazon Prime and just started watching it, which is how I love. That's like my happy place when I really don't know anything about the look or even really the plot, which is hard nowadays. I love just...
Yeah, going in blind is really good. Yeah. I mean, it's sometimes I like to know, I guess, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm of two minds about that a little bit, but I guess I'm really glad in this case I didn't know anything at all.
Same.
And I think that it's safe to say that this is, I just want to say, like, you should see this movie before maybe you listen to this podcast if you're interested in seeing it.
Yes.
Because we kind of have to spoil some stuff in order to have a decent talk about it. We'll try to be careful, but. I think it's really worth seeing and being surprised by it.
Yeah. Plus it's so quirky and I'll use the word weird, you know, for just to make it quick. It's kind of a weird, quirky movie. So it would be hard to kind of get the feel for it without seeing it. Like this movie has such a style to it. The look, the feel, the pacing, the humor, its commitment. I think it's very aware of what it's doing and it is 100% committed to it. To its credit.
Yeah. I really fell for this one. Really fell for it.
I knew
I laughed harder at this than I've laughed in a really long, long time.
It is super genuine, funny.
Genuinely laugh. Like not jokes. They're not, it's character driven. It's absurd. It's surreal. It's kind of cringy.
Yep.
Some of it is the most embarrassing, cringy stuff I've ever seen. There's a love scene in it or kind of a sex scene in it. Oh. That is one of the most, it's like one of the most humiliating, saddest, funniest things I've ever seen. And I think they get that tone just perfectly. I love this movie. I love it.
Yeah. The humor is woven throughout it. In these very, like, you know, uncomfortable situations where this poor character is just the victim of an uncontrollable, unknown paranormal force that is making him appear in people's dreams. And at first, as the movie is kind of in its first couple acts, he's trying to grab onto that for some sort of fame or recognition that he feels he's deserved in his professional career. But then also simultaneously kind of denying that he's doing that in a kind of a brilliant way. And all the humor lies very subtly therein. It's a look. It's a cut. There's a lot of funny editing in this movie. At one point, I thought of you, Tony, because he says something in terms of denying that he's latching on to this when he's accused of that. Like, oh, you, now you're defending it because it serves you. And he goes, no, I'm not. Right when he says it, they cut to this like old portrait of one of the old professors at his school, like looking down at him going, but it's like, that's, yeah. You know what I mean? It's like that level of humor. It's not jokes, as you said, no one falls. It's not that. It's subtly wry humor.
Yeah. I mean, what it reminds me of a little bit is of Charlie Kaufman. So if you like being John Malkovich and you like that kind of surreal, absurd world that has its own internal logic, right? But that's kind of, it's kind of great because this movie, like a few others, it's very real. It feels real. So the fantasy part of it is very lived in, and it's butted up against very normal, very kind of banal human stuff.
Yes.
Making it really funny. And kind of, I guess they used to call this magical realism. But whatever, it's all just really recognizable people and places going through a situation that you just can't believe. And it's just absurd. I love how, like you pointed out, it's really also a character study of just somebody unraveling in the middle of a very modern kind of situation.
Yes.
Which is sudden fame thrust upon you.
Yeah.
Unwittingly, sometimes, you know.
His reactions to this newfound fame, if there is a good use of that term magical realism, I think this movie could be the poster child for it. It's an exact description of what you're seeing. Like, there's nothing in it that uses effects. Everything is very practical, as you said. It's very believable in a sense, but it's like you're in this world that this didn't happen and this couldn't happen and these people wouldn't react like this. And you know, it's silly in that sense, but all very grounded at the same time in terms of performance. It reminded me actually of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Another Charlie Kaufman script.
That's what I kept thinking of, like, where it's got that feel. He does a really good job, Charlie Kaufman, not to get into that because he didn't do this movie, but like this movie does it too. I have this recurring nightmare in my life, and this is in real life. My recurring nightmare is that I find out something in my past I'm allowed to do again that I have regret about. So a lot of times it's like my high school football career. I find out I can go play another year, or my basketball career. Oh, you got another year. And in the dream, I'm like, oh yes. And I'm all fired up and I can't get there. The door's locked and I can hear the game going on, or I can't get my equipment together. It's an anxiety dream of a sense. And this entire movie is like an anxiety dream of this guy who gets something that he thinks is great and it ends up being the biggest curse and everyone is against him. And he's done really nothing wrong at first.
He's done nothing wrong. And what he does do wrong is actually not very wrong either.
No,
like
he
makes very human mistakes with it. And I feel like they're mistakes that I would make. Like a person would make those mistakes.
Yes.
For instance, like it's full of just great sequences and scenes. And one of my favorites is when he finally kind of hits the bottom and his wife is like, why don't you apologize? Because everybody's now, this has gone from everybody kind of being happy that he's been in these kind of innocuous dreams that they're having. And then midway through the movie, of course, the dreams that everybody's having are starting to get really bad and really dark. They're nightmares. And again, he's got nothing to do with it. He's a random, fuddy professor who just happens to be showing up. And he's the most innocuous guy, which is what the humor is kind of based on. He's not dreamy at all. He's just like your typical bald Land's End jacket wearing just kind of schlubby, nice,
slightly annoying too. Slightly annoying.
Yeah, he's annoying, but insecure.
Not an insecure.
And neurotic.
And
but in a very human way too. Yeah. Like it's a recognizable.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, here's the thing. I think like we've seen a lot of kind of broad comedies around subjects like this.
Yeah.
And what a cast, right? Great ensemble.
There's a couple performances in here. I wrote a girl's name down, two girls' names who just nailed what they were doing. Kate Berlant, who played the Michael Cera's company's his number two. She is so condescending. And so it's every ad agency I've ever been in, like every company like that, it's like, that's them. They talk to you so condescendingly and they have that corporate speak. They don't even realize they're doing it, I think. to an extent.
When you see this performance, you'll be like, "Oh, this is too much." And then, but really, it's not. It's exactly how people are in those rooms.
They really are. It's like, oh man, if this might be the most realistic. I wrote this in my notes. See what you think of this, and see like that scene in particular. This might be the most effective devil movie I've ever seen, because, you know, I'm being somewhat facetious, but like that company and everything that happens because of what happens to him.
Yeah, everything goes wrong.
It's the everything devil, goes man. Wrong
the minute yes. he agrees to work with those
yes,
guys.
It's exactly. true. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're just so excited to have you here.
Oh yeah, we're really fired up. It's probably really overwhelming, right, to walk into a room like this. It's like, who are these people? What am I doing here? Maybe we should back up and just talk about what we do.
Yeah, yeah. So we started Thoughts earlier this year, so we're a pretty new agency. And we focus mostly online, sort of trying to holistically pair brands and more, shall we say, unconventional celebrities, if that makes sense. And I think of you right now, in this moment, Paul, as the most interesting person in the world.
And everything is kind of like he's in people's dreams, but he's not doing anything. He's just like, what's really funny is sometimes he'll show up in people's nightmares, but he's just wandering around. Like he's not doing anything. Right. And he starts to get kind of frustrated that nobody's dreaming of him doing anything interesting.
Right.
And then when that starts to happen is when he makes the deal with that company. What a great company. Thoughts?
It makes your skin crawl. He's like, we're exploring the digital space or something to that effect. And you're just like, yeah.
It was also about like different kinds of celebrities, like a new brand of celebrity that they're looking for.
Influencers, et cetera, et cetera.
And then Michael Cera says that in his opinion, he's the most interesting person in the world right now.
Yes. Yes. And then of course,
Cage's reaction to that, I could watch again and again and again.
So
the
many
subtlety of his shifting into agreeing with this is great.
He's such an enigma because he's so talented of an actor and he shows it in this movie and there's so much subtlety. And then he's able to like be really broad too. It's not a knock, but there were like another sports analogy here. There were like basketball players I played with who were so wildly talented, but they would shoot too much occasionally. And sometimes my concern with Nick Cage is that his going for it, which I admire, takes me out of it sometimes. And I'm thinking about him going for it, if that makes sense. But in this movie, he does go for it, but it works because he's almost doing a performance as that character in that world. Like, for example, when he gets big, it's because he's like practicing meeting someone and that character is nervous and neurotic and not comfortable around other people. So he's like ramping himself up. So the bigness works. It's not just Nick Cage stretching his muscles and doing a wacky gonzo performance. He's like in that character. And I think it really works in this film. All the kind of Nick Cage-iness works.
I think so too. This is really like this, I guess, and Pig are now two movies I really love. And I think he's really great in them. He's challenged me over the years. You know, I think he's challenged all of us over the years. I've just come down on the side of the fact that I'm always entertained. Number one, no matter what is happening, whether I think it's a good or bad performance, I'm always getting my money's worth. And that's, you know, there's something to be said for that. He's a movie star after all. I mean,
absolutely.
And so that's good. And I agree. It can be a little much, I think, in the wrong hands or the director who doesn't maybe know how to use his energy. Right.
Right.
I think sometimes it comes off a little strident or a little pushy or a little like just taking over the movie.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that always happens. Like, who knows? Maybe he secretly feels like a movie's not really working and he's just got to like, all right, well, I gotta do something. But I just got the feeling like he really believed in this script and he decided to show up. And you know, he's a really funny, it's a very funny performance, but
it so is.
Much more dialed down than you're thinking.
Yeah. Yep. There's a line of that made me laugh out loud early in the movie. So again, he's appearing in people's dreams. He's a college tenured professor. And as Tony mentioned, he's just appearing in these dreams. and not really doing anything in him, which kind of mirrors his frustration of his life. He feels like he hasn't done anything. He wants to write a book, but hasn't done it. So it kind of fits who he is, and that kind of frustrates him. He's like, oh, I'm famous for this thing now. This is awesome, but I don't do anything there either. But then there's a moment where he finds out just how vast it is, how many people's dreams he's appearing in, hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands, maybe around the world. And he sees that he wants to be interviewed by a news agency, like a local news channel. And he goes, honey, they want to interview me. And his wife says, well, hold on a second. This might not be a good thing. Why don't you take some time and think about it? He looks up all thoughtful, like, and it just smash cuts to him in the news segment. You knew he was going to do that. It was so well done. It was like it was just fantastic. I love
how he's called Area Man in the news clip, too.
That's his lower third, Area Man.
And I love when he's going through some little comments on social media where he's going through like the Twitter feeds right when this is starting to happen. Yeah. And he's realizing how big it is. And he's looking at people's reactions to that video and all the comments and stuff. And one girl says, I kind of don't like going to bed now. It's like,
yeah, one of the comments.
He's typed it out. Yeah.
Which is a foreshadowing of what's to come.
Yes.
A little later in a sense. You know, there's another scene after that that's such a good piece of acting by him. It's filled with it. But he goes back to his humdrum professorship. And they show earlier scenes of him teaching. And you get the sense that he's maybe not the most effective teacher in the world, although committed and into it. The students, maybe it's more the students' problem, but just kind of like a bored Gen Z, just like not buying his excitement level.
And admittedly teaching something that's pretty dry and complicated and scientific and technical.
He's turned on by it.
Yeah. He genuinely loves it.
Yes. So later after he becomes famous for this, the class becomes like the class to go to, cause he's the professor who's appearing in people's dreams, who's now famous locally. And there's a great scene where he comes into that first class and he realizes how crowded it is. And he's at the same time trying to deflect it and not act like he's into it, but his glee of that this is happening to him, he cannot contain it. And I just thought that scene was so well acted by him.
Yes.
And the students, and him asking people what he's doing in the dream. And one by one, they basically say nothing. And his slight frustration that's growing now. So he has to go through like five different little levels of emotional reaction to this thing, pretending he's not into it, unable to hide his glee, and then unable to hide his disappointment. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, man, that's a great piece of acting he just did.
And I'll add to that, there's also a subtle thing, I think, of him being genuinely interested in the scientific weird conundrum that's happening.
Great point. Great point.
And nobody else is.
Great point.
Nobody.
Does, yeah. I
nobody
that.
Is
yeah.
interested in what's going on. And he seems to be like constantly bemused and trying to say, well, let's try to talk about this and see what it is. And everybody just wants to talk about the celebrity part of it. That's the only thing they're interested in.
Yes. Yes. And he kind of
gets sucked into that, but I don't feel like that's his fault. It's like culturally, that's just where everything kind of goes. So he ends up kind of going with the current of it. And that's ends up being a huge mistake. But I just like how, I really like how, you know, nice this movie really is to people, despite it being a pretty black comedy. I mean, it's pretty biting. It's very satirical. It punches at everything and everybody. And that's great. But it really doesn't do so at the expense of people or making them cartoons or, for instance, I mean, I think, you know, his wife, played by Julianne Nicholson, who I've liked for years in a lot of different things.
She's good, man.
Man, is she good. Man, does she take this seriously and also manages to be so deeply funny, but without like any jokes or anything. And their scene where she in the bedroom, when they're just the two of them having that kind of like confession with each other where, you know, she's a little jealous of everybody dreaming about him because she doesn't dream about him. She's the one person in his life that hasn't had dreams about him, which he's kind of upset about, you know, kind of puts him off a little bit. And she's weird that she's not, and other people are. And then they're like, he's just like, what if people are dreaming about me sexually right now? And she doesn't know how to handle that. And then he gets her to talk about what her sexual fantasy is. And that's one of my favorite scenes in the movie. Just how she handles that moment of kind of being really shy with her husband, who she's known forever, and confessing this fantasy, which is so adorable and not sexy and not what he thinks it's going to be. And her reaction to it is so heartbreaking. It's so good, man. So good.
It's like awkward and cute. And yeah, innocent. Her innocence is like exposed in that moment, because he's trying to be playfully naughty as a, you know, a married couple, an adult married couple would be in their bedroom. And she's
and feeling
like,
a little sexier because he's getting all this attention.
Yeah, yeah. And like, hey, what do you think about that? And playing out, so tell me what you'd want. She says this really benign thing, this simply cute, benign thing. Yeah. And it's really good. Another thing this movie does really well in terms of them, he uses this couple to highlight the lies we tell to our significant others or to the people in our lives, i.e. ourselves, the lies we tell to ourselves. And there's a couple's early scenes when he does things and you see the reality of it, which was timid, awkward, maybe even cowardly, gets taken advantage of to an extent. And then presents to his wife, they're like, oh, we're handling it. We're handling it. And I thought, it's so condemning, because like, how many times do we do that in our lives? We tell these stories to others, really to ourselves. Oh, I did this. I told him this. Like, did you really? And then, but what's very interesting is the wife does it too. She is at work. She has an exchange with a coworker. She heartbreakingly again offers her services to do more and gets totally in a polite, very realistic way. She gets Heisman'd. She gets the stiff arm. She gets the, oh, yeah. And then the next thing you know, they're in their bedroom and Nick Cage is saying to his wife, oh, so you're part of that project now. She goes, yes, they've asked me to be part of that project. It's like, oh, no, they didn't. Yeah. And she knows they didn't. But we tell that to ourselves at some level. And then we tell our partners or people in our lives these things. And it's, boy, what an honest
piece. And it's totally understandable. You know, it's totally
yes.
Your heart breaks because you're like, oh, I get it. We've all done that.
I've done that. Yeah, you tell your version of stories, right?
Yeah. And
then
how,
it's funny. So right around then, someone says, all memes become dreams. They use that line.
Brilliant.
And, and I thought to myself, that's kind of what's happening there in a sense. Like, you're presenting a meme version of what really happened. And that becomes your dream. That becomes your like fantasy or reality. The reality was much maybe sadder or more complex or not what you're telling yourself and others it really was. And I think it's like a self-protection, maybe not to get too armchair psychologist, but I think this movie is really smart about kind of exploring those type of thoughts. Like what's real, what's a meme, what means something.
Yeah. And in a way it also, I mean, this is clearly a movie you could talk about from a lot of different angles, lot of different interpretations of it and stuff. Yeah. And all of them kind of work. But I also, one of my favorite things about it is how it's also not a movie about social media or the ills of cancel culture. It's about those things.
It brings it up.
That's in there. But it's also, like, it's also its own thing. It's also really just a story about what this guy is going through. And and so it doesn't lean heavily on moralizing at all. Like, it doesn't even lean at all into it. It just kind of shows what happens to people emotionally inside when these weird events that happen that are kind of new, kind of modern events, you know?
What is very interesting, and I love your thoughts on this, I'm curious, to what extent do you think the filmmakers wanted us, or what they were saying, coming off your point of like, it was also just a story, but I was interested in kind of what they were critiquing and saying. Some of it I think is kind of obvious. Some of it they said, the product at the end, which we'll get to, but I'm more interested in terms of when it went bad, I noticed a slight connection between when he starts getting frustrated and angry and his life starts really falling apart around the time he signs that deal and things are getting bigger. That's when the dreams shift to violence and he's killing people and hurting them and, you know, acting out, doing all these horrible, scary things to people in their dreams, murdering them. And I thought, well, this thing just happened to him, right? But there may be a slight correlation hinted at that as he gets darker and his life circumstances get darker, so do the dreams. And I just thought that was very interesting. Like,
yeah,
a correlation.
Yeah, it definitely is. I think I'm struck by another aspect of the movie that we haven't talked about yet. So, because we could talk forever about what these different things might mean in terms of like breaking them down, rationalizing them, going, well, that this absurd moment means this. And I'm a little adverse to that kind of thinking where it's like, yeah, this surreal, beautiful, crazy moment actually means this very normal thing. You know, and it's not always the case. Sometimes I think there's the idea, like if your story is that just interesting, just him following it along naturally, moment by moment, page, like what would actually happen if this happened to this guy? Naturally, all these kind of things come into it. So I don't know what was there initially, whether it was like this idea, but I have a feeling it came from something completely different, because this movie is also, I don't know whether you picked up on the really, 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 really heavy Eyes Wide Shut homage that this movie actually is in every single part of its DNA.
No.
And in fact, the movie, I firmly believe, is a absolute love letter to Kubrick's last movie.
Ah. Well, I can see in that scene, the scene we mentioned earlier in the bed, that, you know, the intimacy between them. There are
versions of the scenes from Eyes Wide Shut throughout the movie.
Oh, yeah. And then he goes to that girl's apartment.
Yes, after he gets jealous and they get a little jealous. He goes off and has that weird thing with that girl.
Yeah.
But it's also around Christmas time, Halloween time. There's neon lights. The color palette is exactly the same. Go look at Eyes Wide Shut. Take a still grab of that and then go look at this.
Interesting. Okay.
The same film grain look, the same like really saturated reds. Their house looks the same. They have original art on the walls that mimic Christian Kubrick's art that was actually hanging in the walls of Eyes Wide Shut.
Oh,
like,
wow.
It is a wormhole of insane homage to that film. And I've seen this one twice, and I've just started finding the stuff that's in there about it. It's crazy.
So which secret cabal is this movie exposing?
Norio.
Yeah, that's right. Well, okay, great. So it's funny, we just did, all right, so the movie, let's get to the last half of the movie. So things go bad, he's murdering people in their dreams. As this is happening, his personal life falls apart, his professional life falls apart, something that he was worried about happens, he gets completely ripped off, loses everything, and there's a
can't go out in public anymore, like,
right.
Yeah.
He loses his job. The students are so scared to be in his class that there has to be an intervention. And this might be one of my favorite scenes
so good.
Of the year. It's going to be one of my favorite scenes of the year. It's up for a Matty and Tony Award right away. They have to have this kind of, I don't want to offend anyone, this kind of modernist, Gen Z, kumbaya safety meeting. So it's led by a woman.
She was so good in this part.
She's running this meeting with the students, and she's saying, I'm here to show you that this man is a nice man. He's a professor. He's just appearing in dreams. And it's this long setup. And he appears. You know it's coming, but they drag it out. Step a little closer. Is everyone okay? If you feel unsafe, just say calmly, Mrs. Smith, let me know. And they just know what's coming. And he just goes, so just, the students just lose their minds.
It's like a stampede out of the building.
And I was like, this whole scene was like a Norm Macdonald joke. It was like just a big, long, hilarious setup. What you knew was coming, but it's executed so perfectly. And yes, guess what? When he's standing in the gym at this long shot, he somehow looks terrifying. This benign, nerdy professor. The way he's shot, the way they do it, when he stands up against walls and just does the stuff that he means nothing by it.
It's great.
Terrifying somehow.
It's true.
It's so,
and then
hilarious.
Yeah.
I know a lot of you have had very upsetting dreams about your professor. These dreams suggest that Paul Matthews is a harmful person. So your mind is trying to protect you, make you safe by creating certain emotional triggers, motivating you to avoid him. I want to diffuse those triggers. by showing you that Paul is in fact a kind, loving, harmless human being.
When you start to see the nightmares that they're having and he's appearing in them, he is truly terrifying. And like, yes, he actually starts to dream about himself. And that's one of the scariest things in the movie. It really does, I think, fulfill my idea of a perfect comedy horror movie.
Mm.
This really does it. Wow. I think, because yeah, when it's scary, it's really freaky, man. There's some very kind of great horror moments in this thing, but it never is at the expense of it being genuinely funny and kind of genuinely real.
Yes. And and the humor again comes from the almost absurdist nature of the world being against him. And a prime example of that, because it just keeps ratcheting up one thing after the other. Yeah. And he finally, his wife suggests that he apologize. He's like, apologize. I'm not doing anything wrong. And then he's been beaten up, physically abused. He's lost everything. Job, friends, family doesn't love him anymore. Pretty much. The daughters are scared of him. The students are scared of him. He's lost everything. And he finally listens to the wife's advice and gives this unbelievably effective acting performance by Nick Cage.
Yeah, it's
he breaks down tearfully and says, I was wrong for doubting you. I've now suffered from dreams of myself killing myself. And he cries, and it's just unbelievable.
uncomfortable and awkward.
Yes. Like, he's really just like emotionally pouring himself out to the public. And he's like saying to the wife, basically, like, I did it. And she's like, it was completely insincere and self-serving. I know. I'm like, this guy cannot win. It's the ultimate bad day movie in a way. It's the ultimate, you know, Harry Smith had a bad day.
I know.
Let me start with this. I'm sorry. I'm sorry I didn't address this earlier. I'm sorry to anyone who's had one of those terrible, terrible nightmares. The reason why I'm so emotionally distressed right now is because I had one myself. I've experienced what so many of you must have experienced. Being violently attacked and abused by a man who looks like me. I have to stress, that man is not me. Is it really fair that I should be punished for that? Am I not the biggest victim in this whole phenomenon? Just look at how it's affecting my life.
When his daughters are watching the thing during the actual live feed of it, and one daughter's like, I'm gonna kill myself, and the other daughter's like, what is he doing?
But because people imagine I've done things,
I'm actually gonna have to kill myself.
Is it really fair that I should be?
What is he doing?
And it's so heartfelt, but even in the moment, you're like, don't do it, man.
Don't do it. It's a mistake. Yeah.
It's.
And then him, the one person who, like, he finally listened to her, and she's like, that was terrible. It's just like nothing else could go wrong. And then it does. What it's wrestling with, too, it ends, spoiler alert, we won't quite give it away, but we can say this. It ends with a fake commercial, a fictional commercial for a product.
Near the end.
That could somehow utilize what has happened to him. There may be a technology by which they can make happen what happened, we don't know why, with him appearing in people's dreams. And I thought, first of all, well, this would have been maybe number one on both our lists. We just did a fictional commercial in movies top three last week.
Yeah.
And Norio, as it's called.
Norio.
But then here's the freaky thing, Tony. I took a screen grab of it just to tell you about it. I don't think you can see it. See that ring?
Yeah.
I stopped the movie, and on my email is an ad. So the fake product is named Norio in this movie that can somehow get you in people's dreams to basically do advertising. This ring is called Aura, O-U-R-A, with like a weird little, and it looks so much like the Norio ad. And it's a ring with all these like crazy lights in it that you wear. And it says, stay on top of your health, track your sleep, activity, recovery, and more in style. And I'm going, this is a Norio ad. And like, it was I shut the movie off, and that popped up on my phone. I'm like,
yeah,
holy moly. And now people are wearing those like Apple masks and
absolutely doing, yeah, like, it's not that far off. I mean, the movie does off. Kind of take a turn into a little bit more hard satire at that moment, yeah, which I love, and I think it funny. Earns.
Yep.
If you liked Sorry to Bother You, you know, that's another movie that has similar DNA, except that's a lot broader. Yeah. It takes a turn into a way of like, oh, we're in a slightly different universe here. But they both earn it. This one totally earns it. And it ties back into his story. It doesn't like just end with that snarky commercial and then we're out.
Thank God.
He does something about it and does something with it.
What a beautiful, that we won't spoil. What a beautiful little scene that was.
It ends really, really well. Yeah. Look, can we just talk for a second about Tim Meadows? Can we just talk about should be the fun? Why isn't he? Everybody know he's the funniest guy on the planet. That man can show up on screen. And before I know what's happening or who's what, I'm laughing my ass off just because of the way he will look at somebody. Are you equally just devastated by Tim Meadows?
Yeah. I mean, he keeps showing up and so subtly crushing everything he's ever
kills
been.
It.
Yeah.
He just kills me, man. I love him. His basement is one of the best things in this movie too. He invites him to sleep over when his life falls apart. He goes, well, you could stay with me. And it's like, I almost thought the top three should be like the worst, like transitional living spaces, areas.
I thought of it too. Like worse divorce apartments or something. Yeah, it does kind of explore that at the end a little bit. And that's that podcast I mentioned at the beginning. I was listening to this podcast, and it's about transhumanism. And there's this really popular new movement. It seems to be kind of run by billionaires who want to live forever is the basic way you could look at it, right? And this theologian priest who is kind of being interviewed, he got his doctorate in transhumanism evolution, like the evolution of transhumanism, because he said, I think that the church, in this case the Catholic Church, needs to look at this phenomenon and just come up with what we think about it, because it's happening faster than anyone can, like, we just have to process this. And one of the things he said that I thought maybe this movie was a little bit about, this guy said, everyone keeps saying that technology is going too far, this transhumanism is going too far, AI is going too far. He goes, we're coming to the belief that maybe the problem is it doesn't go far enough, in terms of all it cares about is your physical body living as long as it can possibly live, to the detriment of anything else. And it's like satiating your needs at the time you need it, you know, your next meal, your next health thing, your next, and there's no thought of others in your life. There's no thought of spirit. There's no thought of anything that might be beyond the actual human body, spirit, if you will. So it's like, I thought maybe this, when I saw the millennial advertisers in his dream advertising his things, it's like, yeah, it doesn't go deep enough. They think it's going too far. It actually doesn't go far enough. It just focuses back in on you and your own self. And this is
sure.
Is that fair? Well, and that's his whole character.
I agree. Cause I think that, you know, there's a lot of real interesting theological philosophy in this movie that is just kind of baked in, where they don't talk about it, which is great. They just kind of show you the effects of it. And, I totally agree with that. And I think that not only that, but everything, like the end result is what we were saying before. No one's interested in this phenomenon, the amazing miracle that's happening here. They immediately go to, how can we capitalize on it? How can I go into somebody's dream and sell them something? Really? Rather than for 1 second sit there and go, my God, this is incredible.
That's,
you know,
it.
And I think that's something that we see in our culture. We talk about that with, like, you know, the disclosure movement, and how we're kind of shocked by a lack of interest, just a general lack of interest or curiosity in this. I think because people are like, well, what's in it for me? I can't make money off of it. I can't, you know.
God,
so
that's it.
His character seems to be like just kind of yearning for a conversation about this. Someone be interested. Like, why am I in your dream? It's not about me. I'm not doing it. I want to know why. And everybody makes it about him. So it's kind of, he becomes narcissistic almost because the society demands that he do it. you know, which is a deeper comment than just social media or anything like that.
Yes.
That's a really dark thing about our culture right now.
What's in it for me? And the fact that everything we're talking about is all true and all there, but at the end of the day, it's such a love story. And I love that about this movie. It's a love story.
It really is. It creeps up on you, and it really does. It's about love, and it's about, you know, family, and about different things. That's why I'm like, I think it has other things on its mind. I mean, like, it has all these things on its mind, but it's really passionate about, this filmmaker is really passionate about these people and what it feels like to go through it. And in that way, I thought it was actually a great paranormal movie, because in a strange way, this is how people deal with the unknown. You know, as you were saying earlier, like, the reactions are crazy. It's like, in fact, I think they're crazy just the way that we really do react. Vis-a-vis, you know, government says there's UFOs, we don't know what they are, and everybody's like, oh, okay, well, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And they try to categorize it in a way that either helps them or makes sense to them, or, you know, they, instead of exploring it in any sort of open way, it's like, this is that. Or I can use it for this. Or
how can I use it? What's my next meal? How do I game the system? Thoughts? Awesome. Exclamation, you know, a question mark being the perfect name for their company. Thoughts?
So good. Yeah, I said her name earlier, like Kate Berlant. She is, if you've ever been in a casting session at a huge agency in the commercial world, that's exactly what it feels like.
It's not overacting, folks. That is what it's like.
Any favorite lines? Anything we've left on the table? Tony, you always have a few things that we didn't get to. I've got a favorite line. Well, there's many, but I wrote down.
I do. I have a lot of favorite lines. One of them, we both know you score high on neuroticism. It's best to just own it and be pragmatic about it. She says, well, you score high on assholeness.
It's best to just accept it and be pragmatic about it. So good. I love the line when it's all gone bad and the Thoughts company is thinking of using him for to be a nefarious character online or wherever. And he says, is there any kind of charity I could do with the girl? Curtly, this again, that same girl, Kate Berlant, goes, charity? That's sweet, but no.
It just, like, so matter shuts it down immediately. Best sandwich throwing at diner I've ever seen.
Oh, his nerdy sandwich throw.
The conniption fit is fantastic.
The professor. Oh, so good. Oh, God,
it's good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know what to say, man. I love this. This guy, this director, this writer, his name is Christopher Borgli. He's from Norway. This is his fourth feature film. He also edited this, and this is one of the best edited films I've seen in ages. It's so brilliant.
The editing is responsible for some of the laugh out loud moments.
Yeah, no,
there's a quick cutaway. Again, there's this subplot of some infidelity between both the husband and wife, or situations where they could be unfaithful. And Nick Cage is worried about that, this one particular guy. And after he's shut out of everything in his life, there's a scene where he goes to watch his daughters play and all hell breaks loose. And there's just a quick cutaway to the guy who he's worried about sitting next to his wife and his kids on play. But that's it. There's no reference to it. It's just
no reacting to it. It's no. Just there.
And you don't even have a chance as the audience member to kind of go, wait a second. Ooh. It's just, that's editing.
Meanwhile, cutting back to his daughter on stage in a buddy costume, screaming and crying at the horror.
Oh my God. Yeah, really well edited.
This guy is, watch this guy's work. He's come to play. Christopher Borgli has come to play.
I'm going to go back and watch maybe some of his early movies now.
I definitely am.
All right. So probably easy to tell. You probably don't need to insert yourself into our dreams to be able to tell whether we're going to put this in the shelf or not and give it a P for Paranormal. Tony, what say you?
On the shelf, P for Paranormal.
Agreed. Absolutely. Yeah. Agreed. All right. Top three based on this movie. Top three going full nerd in movie history.
I wish I was the one people were dreaming about.
Me too.
Yeah. No, it's something.
Tony. Do we want to memorialize this award? I was thinking, I don't want to take one of your number ones.
No, go ahead. I have a lot. I haven't even, okay. I have a bunch in that I don't have an order yet. So you can go ahead.
I mean, I was thinking, because it's a paranormal movie, and it might be the ultimate nerd character, and he's in a paranormal movie, would be Egon Spengler. Maybe we call it the Egon Spengler Award.
You can call it the Spanglers, sure.
Spengler?
And okay. That doesn't, you know, I went Rick Moranis.
Great.
But I mean, who's the bigger nerd? I don't know.
Right. Right.
That's fine. The Spengler is good.
Okay. Let's start with you, number three.
Number three, let's go with Kei Hiu Kwan from Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Oh, great one. Wow.
He's that performance really, really touched me, and partly because just his comeback was so beautiful to watch, you know, and so incredibly touching to see him like talking to Harrison Ford again after 40 years and stuff. It was really cool. But he was a pretty big nerd in that movie, and I thought he was great. He went full nerd.
That's a great one. I totally didn't even think about that, but that's a great one. Number three. Now, I haven't seen this movie since it came out, and I remember really enjoying it. So I don't know. I'm a little hesitant because I don't know if it'd hold up if I watch it again. It's 2010, I believe. Scott Pilgrim in Scott Pilgrim versus the World. He's a nerdy kid who has to do a battle in this kind of comic book universe against his wannabe girlfriend's ex-boyfriends. And I remember just really being charmed by it and loving it when I saw it in the theater. So it was kind of the first thing I thought about when you brought up the nerd topic, and especially in a supernatural setting.
That's great. And it's Michael Cera, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Who's in this movie. That's the other reason I thought of it, I think, because he was so good in this too.
Yeah. That's a great call. That's a really good call. Okay, cool. I'm going to go with, who am I going to pick next? I'm going to say I really was struck by this Matt Damon performance in the movie called The Informant.
Oh yeah.
Where he plays like a guy who is kind of thinks he's working for the CIA as an informant for something or the FBI. And he's real nerd, Midwest suburban nerdy guy, and pulls it off, I think, very effectively.
He does. I forgot all about that performance. That's a great one too. Number two, I'm going to go one of my favorite movies, Unbreakable, Sam Jackson as Elijah Price. I consider him a nerd because, you know, super comic book collector, outcast, his nerdiness turns into, you know, nefariousness.
Okay.
But at his core, he's a comic book nerd.
That's an interesting call. I like that. Okay.
He went full nerd, full angry nerd.
Full nerd, yeah. Nerd, well, no, I mean, then there's arguably a whole other category of like the scary nerds.
Yep.
Like, you know, Michael Douglas in Falling Down is kind of a nerd, but that's a different kind of nerd.
Right. Outcast, maybe more than nerd. I've always said what I found so great about Napoleon Dynamite is like all the nerds I knew in high school were like kind of cocky. Nerds are always portrayed in movies and TV as like these hapless, like helpless victims.
Oh, they're not timid necessarily. No.
But like the nerds in high school, they're like in the corner, like, those jocks are totally lame. You guys don't even understand how cool Dungeons and Dragons is. You know what I mean? Like they were cocky. They're always talking about swords and like sword fights. It's like, I was kind of scared of them.
They'd punch you.
I know.
They would punch you in the nose. I'm going to go with, I think my number one really has to be Elaine May. In A New Leaf, her directorial debut, she is in with Walter Matthau, and she plays the biggest nerd in the world, and it's one of the greatest nerd performances ever.
That's awesome. I just realized we could have called it the Clark Kent Award.
Yeah, actually, you know, I thought of Chris Reeves, but he's not.
I think I'm going to go for number one. I consider him a nerd, even though he's totally cool. It might be a bit of a cheat, because Sean from Shaun of the Dead, you know, when we first meet him.
He's total, kind of a nerd.
Yeah, gamer, record collector, outsider.
He does have a girlfriend, though.
True. I thought of that, too. I'm like, but nerds can have girlfriends, right?
Okay. I mean, it's they can, but I think it's just, it's maybe
hurts.
A point, one point, half point off.
That's a really
but,
good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she's not a robot or something, yeah.
Do you have any runners-up?
Back to the Future, Doc.
Oh, How about Dad in Back to the Future?
Oh my God, I thought of him as my number one. Actually.
Yeah, Crispin Glover is a pretty great nerd in that.
How about the Predator alien? He collects spines and skulls.
He's a collector. He's a big nerd collector. It's true. He's very anal about them. They're very carefully organized.
You know, it was a little nerdy in that movie is Shane Black, who actually wrote it. He's one of the soldiers, and he's got the horn rim glasses.
Yeah,
he's like a big nerdy nerd in real life. Yeah.
I had some other ones too. I thought, you know, Peter Sellers as the Mandrake character in Doctor Strangelove is one of the great nerds of all time.
Yes.
As I think, you know, you could say that, you know, Ralph Nedry in Jurassic Park, pretty full nerd. Like he went perhaps too full nerd. I feel that he maybe pushed it a little bit far.
You just reminded me of a tech gadget nerd with your Jurassic Park pick. How about Q from the James Bond series?
Big like nerd, great.
Whoever plays Q is always like this nerdy nerd. Is like, you know, just totally into tech. Great. Nerds out about tech. Yeah.
Great nerd. Any other last nerds?
I think that's it, buddy. Just me.
What do you
nerd out about?
You do sports.
Yeah, but I nerd out about, like, I'm a golf nerd. I'm a drum nerd. I'm a Black Crowes nerd.
I get nerdy about stuff. You do. You get real nerdy.
What do you get nerdy about? Well, film.
Oh, you know, man. You know, movies. And
art.
Steely Dan.
Drawing. Steely Dan.
Yeah.
Drawing.
I mean, you know, I get nerdy about all the liberal arts. Put it that. Heavy metal and.
Yes.
A total big nerd.
Yeah.
You know, I do get a point off for being married. I'm married, and I feel that doesn't, you know, that's a little bit of a point off my nerd cred, maybe.
Yeah, nerd street cred. That is true.
Have you ever seen The Road to Wellville? Anthony Hopkins. There's my pick for special nerd.
Ultimate nerd.
Maybe the ultimate nerd. I've never seen anybody go more full nerd ever. Than Anthony Hopkins did.
Even more than Jerry Lewis?
It's like Jerry Lewis. He puts on fake buck teeth and has a crazy accent. And it's like, you're like, Anthony, Sir Anthony, take it down a notch. So next up for us will be the HBO or Max series 30 Coins, which I know friend of show Michael King will be very excited about. He's been trying to get us to talk about this show for a long time. And now I think we have enough of a break to actually tackle several episodes of that first season, which we'll talk about when we next get together.
Dig it. We will do it then. All right, Tony, we'll see you soon. Thank you, everybody.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Rated P for Paranormal. Please rate, review, and share. It really does make a difference. For more information, to participate, and even donate, go to our main page, anchor.fm/ratedparanormal. On social media, we're at Rated Paranormal. All music is by Andrew Galdens Jr. You can find him on Instagram at Kid Riga, or go to therocketscience.bandcamp.com. This podcast was created, written, produced, and edited by Maddie Blake and Anthony Arkin.
It may look like he's just resting, but right now, Brian's inside the dream of a random 19-year-old boy.
It's refreshing.
I really don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, no one does.